Our conversations in this episode have already shown what aligned support can look like, a trusted adult who stays, interventions fitted to the child and context, and teams that remain responsible when needs are complex. Kwesi Rowlands asks a related harder question: who holds power inside those arrangements, and how do we know whether community engagement and family and youth voice are real rather than just claimed? Kwesi has spent decades working at the intersection of family and community engagement, leadership development, and cross-sector collaboration. Like John Lockman, who taught us not to only focus on the behavior visible in the moment, Kwesi asks us not to trust the values an institution claims for itself. He starts from a favorite image of his own: stop 10 superintendents on the street and ask whether family engagement matters, and 10 out of 10 will say yes. The real evidence, he tells us, is elsewhere, in budgets, staffing, cabinet meetings and membership, meeting times, language access, and what actually happens when a family disagrees with the professionals in the room. For Kwesi, community engagement is a capacity, not just a set of individual skills. Organizations must provide the time, structure, authority, and support that let people use those skills well. A meeting scheduled during a parent's second job is not accessible. An interpreter cannot help if professionals are speaking in jargon that cannot be translated. A young person given a seat on a board has not been empowered if the discussion is incomprehensible and no one supports their participation. One of Kwesi's most useful ideas is about leveraging position. Every role comes with limits, but also with real opportunities to act. Kwesi describes a moment when he noticed that interpreters had quietly stopped translating because a meeting had drifted into jargon. He used his position to stop the discussion, name what was happening, and bring everyone back in. The moment was small, but it shows what inclusion actually requires: attention, authority, and a willingness to interrupt normal procedure. He is just as clear that speaking up is not automatically helpful, and that reflective practitioners ask whether their intervention was too forceful, too hesitant, or displaced somebody else's voice. Kwesi grounds all of this in an example: the Homework Diner, a dinner hosted right at the school, funded and staffed by community partners rather than the school itself, where families eat together and do the homework with their kids in the same room. The idea took hold years ago after a skeptical principal touring a district that had already figured it out asked the obvious question: how do you pay for the food when the school cannot legally buy it? The answer was simple: that's what partners are for. This was not simply a successful family event. It shows what supported community engagement capacity looks like in practice. Partners pooling funds and roles, removing logistical barriers, and creating a setting where families experience one coherent response without needing to know which funding stream paid for the meal or which partner supplied the staff. Listen to the test Kwesi applies throughout and notice where you may apply it yourself. Do our values show up in how we organize? Are people merely invited or genuinely enabled to participate? Do we use our position to open space for others? And are we willing to change our own behavior when reflection shows that our practice falls short of our principles? Welcome, Kwesi. It is such a pleasure to have you with me. I've really learned so much from you over the course of the last 25 years as we've had the good fortune of working together in different ways. And one of the things that I've really appreciated in your vision from the beginning is your understanding, appreciation of, and commitment to the importance of working with families and young people in what I would call a family and youth-driven manner. And while I've written about it, I want people to hear your sense of both how we should be working with families and young people and how you would frame it.
It seems like a question that should be easy to ask, and yet there's a lot of complexity. I think the language that I have now, I didn't have back in the day. I think it just came from kind of a tradition that valued community, a tradition that perhaps was passed on by my parents just in terms of their own stories and their own activity in their church and in their community. And knowing that they made a difference, that made a difference, those relationships made a difference. Even before, long before we had the studies and the language and the frameworks and the diagrams, there's kind of a deep level of knowing that sometimes we get with regard to that. So I've had the privilege to act on that directly throughout my career. Although for a minute there, when I was a really young man, I wasn't quite sure what to do with all that energy and all that anger that I had coming up. But once it got directed toward community and family and voice and kind of honoring that, and frankly, using my own positioning now to piggyback off of sports, we use things like your platform, people using their platforms. We didn't have platforms back in the day, but basically you had positioning, and sometimes you could use your positioning to help others who didn't have positioning get their voices heard. And so I kind of came up through that tradition. I grew up through that tradition. And then as I gained more skills as a practitioner, gained theoretical knowledge through my studies, et cetera, that kind of helped back it up. So I not only had some of the skills and an innate ability to do that, but I also had a deeper understanding of why it was important. And so these days, the way I talk about it is really understanding that doing this kind of work well is a capacity. And just like everything is, you can't just rely on people's kind of innate ability, but you really can help people learn how to do these things better. And we've got to do that kind of work with a lot of intention, because a lot of folks, particularly going back to this idea of positioning, a lot of folks in positions could be doing more, and they often have a big gap between their espoused values and their actual practice, their actual behavior. And that's where a lot of I consider my work, our work as a national intermediary, is my work. I've been mostly in an intermediary kind of setting for most of my career, is really to bridge that gap between espoused value and behavior and practice. And so it's not enough just to believe that we should engage families. It's not enough to believe we should engage students, but we've actually got to do some things. And we've got to also back that up. So if you stop 10 superintendents on the street and ask them if they believe engaging families is good, almost all 10 out of 10 will say yes. But then when you examine their budgets, their structures, their who's on their cabinet, if you go into the nitty-gritty, you'll find this huge gap between their espoused value. Yes, they do believe it's important to engage families, but they're not organized to do that. And they don't have a deep enough understanding of why it's a good idea to do that to achieve some of these other goals that they have to achieve.
You raise both important issues regarding capacity and also about positioning. So let me go further with positioning. I remember reading, and I reviewed it, so I now remember it more, a piece that you were part of that was done for the Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention back in 2001 or 2002. And one of the things you importantly talked about in this planning guide was the importance of asset mapping. Asset mapping has a whole bunch of different roots, but one of its roots goes to the work that John McKnight and Jody Kretzmann did at Northwestern. And I want to invoke an article, a chapter that the late John McKnight had written in the 1970s that was really important. It was framed Professionalized Services and Disabling Help. And why I'm bringing that up is I think positioning and the ethical responsibility I think that we all have if we understand those positions we're in to try to use them is also one that can either be enabling, which is the softball I'm throwing to you, or disabling. And I know that your work has been about enabling. So if you want to riff a little further on that, and then I want to come back to capacity as well.
Yeah, I think, and again, this is the difference between espoused values and behavior. If you don't believe that folks in community, particularly in communities who have been historically underserved, also have assets and also bring things to the table, then you behave in a different way. You behave in ways that avoids involving them. You behave in ways that kind of goes around them because they're not seen as bringing much to the table. Or you certainly don't feel like it's worth the investment to do a little bit more to ensure their voice is heard and that they're understood. And sometimes that little bit more is, hey, how about we not schedule the meeting when they're working their second job and figure out how do we, it's not that they don't want to be involved, it's that you're scheduling the involvement in times that are convenient for you and not for many families. You're arranging the involvement to exist only in one language when you really need to hear from families that speak a different language and have plenty to say, but they just can't say it in English. So you're not arranging to be to, for them to be heard in that way and understood. So I think that's still a key dynamic. We don't use that language as much today, enabling and disabling behavior. I'm old school, much like you now. I like the old stuff sometimes because we are always so in search of the new that we forget that we didn't do the old well. And maybe that's actually the solution. But part of it is valuing. We have now language like funds of knowledge that families hold. But we also know that we have to do a little bit extra is to make sure that they are heard, that they are involved. I remember sitting in a meeting with a group of, it was a superintendent's family kind of cabinet meeting, all these parents, they had interpreters there. The superintendent was on average was doing a lot to make sure that she heard families. And at one point they started using some language and the interpreters stopped talking and translating because they didn't understand the language. And I remember, and nobody else really noticed that. And then I stopped the meeting and said, wait, wait, something happened. We used some jargon. The interpreters didn't know how to translate that jargon into Spanish. So therefore, everybody is not able to participate here. So and again, positioning. I literally was in a position to stop the conversation.
Nicely. Yes. Now.
Then we unpacked the word that was giving them difficulty. I wish I could remember the exact word, but you've seen it in these meetings where at least sometimes this jargon gets everybody or a different set of acronyms. So I was in a position to stop everything and make sure that we went back to everybody participating. But that's probably more the exception than the rules. With that's the other thing is it's not just having positioning, and I know you'll get back to that, but you've got to be willing to do something
Okay. Yeah.
with it. You've got to go beyond the reasonable and not in a disrespectful way. I certainly was not disrespecting that superintendent, but those parents were happy that I stopped the meeting and I was paying attention.
The late Judy Heumann, who was a wonderful disability activist, when she was the assistant secretary for OSERS, when people would come into meetings and she would say, "Can I see the Braille accommodation?" And they said, "Oh, we don't have it. We need more time." She literally said, "Go back. We are not meeting until that happens." And while I did not know the late Harold Washington, I remember because I was in Chicago soon after he died, and I was trying to get a sense of whether or not it was possible to organize a very transformative school in Chicago. And I kept on hearing the same story of Harold Washington as mayor meeting with community groups and saying to them, "Unless you can show me that you are really working together, I'm not dealing with you." And they talked about its impact on them, so that it was his leveraging his positioning, Judy leveraging her positioning, but in the end, to get other people to be leveraging their positioning, because they had the resources to do the Braille translation.
Didn't get around to it. And these things have, there are a million of those stories. And it's really, and it's simply because in that particular setting, I'm paying attention to everything. What happens in a blink of an eye, and then you move on. But I had the presence of mind to say, wait a minute, something, they're not, she's the translator's not talking. And we're still talking. So yeah, we've got to, That's my message to everyone now. It's like you've got to use your platform, your positioning, your authority, whatever you have, where you are in, able to make some level of decision. You've got to be using it well, and you've got to be using it based on a number of things, including evidence, good practice, things we know make sense.
So let me ask you a question that comes out of my thinking, but it connects very much to this whole podcast series. And you may correct me because I may be incorrect here. For decades, I have shared the following, that every position in life comes with constraints, but also it affords opportunities to do good. And that it is important to understand that while we face constraints, and I think the practitioners who are listening right now know all the different constraints that they, many of the different constraints that they face in the work that they're doing. But it's also important to understand what your position and where you are offers an opportunity to do good and to be responsible. So again, I'll invite you to comment.
I think that's largely true. I think that there are lots of reasons why people sometimes don't use their positioning. Sometimes it's just not important enough to them. Sometimes they don't have the courage to do so. Sometimes I think it's nuanced. I think sometimes they're not entirely sure how they should respond or use it. Sometimes it's their own lack of self-confidence and self-efficacy around that. I think part of the key to all of it is reflection. When along the way, as part of my growth process, I realized that the ability to reflect is really, I'm not sure if it's a capacity or not, but at least to try to be more intentional about that. I, for a lot of reasons, for 30 plus years, really have made self-reflection is part of my practice. So I'm always thinking about what I said, what I should have said, what I could have said, what I didn't say, what I could have done. Was I crazy? Especially as one who has a reputation for being blunt, not in a toxic way, but blunt. I will call a spade. I reflect after the fact, was I too harsh? Did I use the right words? Did I, all of that? What are the other dynamics at play? And I think that is something that can help folks realize their own, how to use their own positioning is to be a little bit more intentional about reflecting on. Now, there are times when you've done all you can do, and then that's the answer. You couldn't do more. To do more would have been completely insane or just not a good idea. But there are a lot of times where people just don't speak up when they could, and they've got to figure out what that is. And that's why you need a team also, because when you have members of a team, then some of your team may have the strength that you don't have to say what needs to be said, or someone else may have the skill of saying what needs to be said, but saying it in a way that doesn't kill anybody. So I hope that answers your question, but
Oh,
I think that's part of it. Yeah.
no, I think you have. And in fact, what you've also just done is also shared another key point, which is for people to be able to be reflective practitioners. For example, being in a meeting and having a sense of when one should insert oneself is grounded in one's ongoing reflection. So reflective practice is not just being reflective at the moment of practice. It's also reflecting on and learning from your practice, and often learning with others and deploying teams in the way that you're talking about, because no one person alone can do it as well as a group of people if they distribute their voices and their patience and their styles.
Or get the opinion of colleagues and others who you respect. Was I out of line? Had I lost my mind? Was I on point? Because it's for me, I'm not, as I said, in most collaborative settings, I'm known for being blunt and saying the hard thing out front, naming the elephant in the room, but I don't cultivate that just because I want that to be my persona. I do that because I think it's the right thing to do. So it's important to have some balance with that as well, I have found. And now, of course, as my career completely winds down, so I'm at the height of whatever that is as a younger person. That wasn't always the case. I didn't have the same positioning that I have now, even if I still had that same proclivity toward being honest and asking the hard questions.
And let me just add that I think that that reflection and checking with others is particularly important for my fellow white and white male listeners as well. Meaning, one of the things I'm always asking myself in situations is if I'm asserting myself because no one else is, am I taking the voice away? So there's another thing. You have to do it as well, but I'm always very conscious of that element of my position. So again, I'm reflecting on that. And I have to go to people who come from different positionalities who I respect and work to make me to help me know whether or not I opened my mouth too much or I didn't.
No, it's important. The self-awareness is key, and some folks just don't have it. So the self-awareness, we have terms like emotional intelligence now. Some folks just don't have it, and it is what it is. I consider myself fortunate that I have it and have cultivated it, and so I have a deep level of self-awareness. I choose my words very wisely. I'm just very intentional. All the time. I'm in a field, as you well know, where I'm a male with some authority and surrounded by a lot of females. I'm very conscious about that dynamic. I'm very conscious about not dominating conversations if I don't need to or want to. So these are just good things. These are good practices. And in community, I was in a board meeting with a young lady who finally opened up and shared that she's one of the younger members on this particular board. And so a lot of the language and the jargon was going over her head, and she finally got the courage to say that. And then for our vantage point as her peers on this board, we also recognize we've got to do a better job of making sure we don't use language that's going over her head. And we've got to stop and pause and ask questions and make sure that she's able to fully participate, because it's not enough just to have a parent on the board or a youth on the board or whatever, but it's like they've got to be fully able to participate. And that means we've got to do extra and we've got to be paying attention to that. So it's an ongoing struggle. I think it makes for it's a little bit of extra effort that pays huge dividends down the road.
When I was listening to you, I was thinking about the fact that in a technical assistance center that I led that worked with all the federal mental health system of care sites, we had a bunch of wonderful people who were the senior advisors and came from the field. And Dr. Gail Porter, who was the mental health advisor, was running a meeting with NIMH about evidence-based practices. And what she pulled out is the fact that if you're not family-driven, if you're not getting the voices of families, things happen, for example, saying, this is when the medication should be prescribed. And if you're not giving, taken. And if you're not giving the mother to say, that's a great idea, but you need to know I'm at work at that point. I can't do it. How are we going to handle it? Then what happens is the child doesn't get the medication. And what's written off is the fact that the patient has been and the family has been non-compliant. But in reality, it was that the professional lacked the capacity to engage that family in the way that they could calibrate the intervention.
Yeah, no, I think that's true. And I'm not sure what that is. Maybe it's deadlines, maybe it's other kind of things. There has been a tendency to privilege some information over others and to take shortcuts. Now they're just goo gobs of evidence coming out that a lot of the drugs that have been passed and have gone through trials have only ever been tested on a cross section of society. And that those findings don't automatically apply. Findings that are based on 80% of the results are based on white men in Europe don't apply to black women in the Congo. So it's all these kind of, so little by little, and of course it costs more money to do that level of study, but there are corollaries to this as well. So it takes more time to do it well, but when you do it well, then the benefits are there. If you do it well and sustain that, the benefits are there. And that for me is the corollary. So that even evidence itself sometimes is lacking. It's evidence, but, and that's not to be anti, because I'm all for evidence-based practice. But we also need the time to make sure it can be implemented in the settings where we exist, because cookie cutter doesn't work.
And a key part of that evidence involves listening to the consumer, listening
That's
to the
right.
family,
That's
listening to
right.
the young person, and incorporating their thinking. Let me ask you another question that connects to another area that your work has always been about, which is how to coordinate, align, integrate services, not just within schools, but between schools and communities. And what I want to ask you is, how can leaders in schools and in communities better work with families and young people to ensure that the alignment is not just a paper alignment, but one that is actually embodied in their own experiences?
Yeah, it takes time. You hear some of the same words. It takes time. It takes intention. It takes collaborating and being in dialogue long enough across agencies to find some solutions. It's interesting. I remember taking communities and a group of funders many years ago to visit a school district that was doing community schools. And one of the things that they did to engage families was to have, in Albuquerque now they call it Homework Diner, but before then it was called something else. Basically, all of the partners got together and they hosted dinners at school, and families came and ate with their kids and also did homework. And I remember distinctly, ironically, a principal. So we had brought a delegation of folks representing various that were interested in learning more and doing this. And I remember the principal from this one place, who was part of a community delegation, said, "How do you pay for the food? Because we can't buy food as a school, as a district, right?" And it was a reminder, and then they gave a great answer. That's why you have partners. So the partners pay for the food. So at the end of the day, so the bottom line of the story is the parents and the kids and everybody sitting in the room doing homework together don't care how you pay for the food. They don't really, it's not important to them. They don't need to know. The most important thing is you figured it out through collaboration, and now everybody's benefiting. So the parents are more attached to the school. The kids are more attached. It's linked to learning, which now the evidence says, this is before we had that evidence, that was linked to learning. So the engagement is really off the charts, et cetera. But if it was only left up to the individual school to figure that out, then the immediate limitation is we can't feed families, so we can't do this. But if you're in partnership with other community-based partners, other agencies, other folks, you probably can find a workaround that everybody will appreciate. But you can't get to the workaround if you're not collaborating enough on a shared vision, a shared goal. What are we trying to accomplish together? Which goes to this idea of youth thriving also. What are we trying to accomplish together so we create an environment in which young people can thrive? Now, young people doing homework with their parents and having a meal and the staff and all that's a poster for thriving, an activity that obviously is going to lead to thriving. Years later, that would become a nationally renowned program, Homework Diner, in the place where that principal asked that question 15 years ago, and widespread, and has led to all kinds of intriguing kind of developments that are the kind of example we want. But you never get there unless you answer that question. And then that question obviously got answered because the place we were visiting was not that particular city, but it was a city that was doing that well and had figured that out because they had all of these different agencies collaborating, thinking out loud, figuring out solutions, in position to act. And I think we learned that through COVID as well, that COVID was something that no one was prepared for, but communities that already had a tradition of deep collaboration across agency were in a better position to respond. because they already had a lot of stuff together. They didn't have to figure out how to work together in the midst of a crisis. They were already working together and they could be focused on an unknown crisis.
So just like before, when you were talking about a team of people who might deploy themselves differently, if one is connected, if one has relationships, if one respects and understands each other, then one can more easily braid the funding, right? I can take care of this.
Exactly.
That's within my mandate. You can take care of this. Together, we're much more powerful. And ideally, when it comes to the parent and the child who are doing the homework together, they don't know that. They don't need to know it.
They don't need to know it. They don't care. And that, unfortunately, particularly for historically underserved communities, what they experience is the result that they experience of our inability to work together is we've got to go to 17 different agencies across town to get one thing. They experience that as just complete disconnection, challenge, etc. But when we've got our stuff together, even if it's never a permanent situation, but when we have enough collaboration going together to actually deliver something and keep that going, then families, everybody benefits and they don't need to know the details. And again, it's about who using the positioning. And so I was struck actually because when I'm in this meeting and I'm in this meeting with program officers from a funder of ours as well. So that question caught me off guard. That was the first question that came with, how do you pay for the food? Which you just, and it's, oh, okay, so that's a dilemma. And so all these years later, I always reflect on that reality because it's not that people aren't trying to figure out how to solve these problems, but some of these problems are complex. And so they're not designed, no one agency could solve it anyway.
But I think just as reflection means understanding what is afforded to you by your position, reflection also can include understanding what you can't do and why you need the help of somebody else. So together you can team.
And then this goes back to what leader. So some of this is a leadership question as well. What are you willing to do? And in some settings, because of the environment, a leader is less likely to try to do this innovation because they can't control everything about it. So they're just going to stick with what they can control, which limits the possible response. And we see a lot of that, not just in schools, but we see a lot of that in agencies across the board.
In the episode that follows this, there will be Eric Gordon, who you know, who was involved in an incredible transformation in Cleveland and is now working in another collaborative organization, and Queena Kim from the UCLA Community School that I know you know because you've studied it as well. And they will be providing examples of places that do some of the things you're talking about. I'd like to invite you to describe one other place that you've seen and how it has evolved over time a little, where people were able to build in the way that you've talked about.
There are a lot of places that particular place that we took folks to visit all those years ago was Multnomah County, Portland, Greater Portland. Multnomah County decided to adopt the community school strategy back in the late 90s as an anti-poverty strategy, believe it or not. And the county office of, I guess, health, I can't remember what they were called, they became the lead of it, and they engaged the six school districts in the county that had the most need, and they engaged a lot of nonprofit partners, and they made it all happen. And they grew from when they started their initiative from eight schools to almost better than 100 now community schools, and have had a lot of fits and starts and bumps along the way. Have had federal funding come and go, have had leadership come and go, both at the superintendent level as well as county leadership, city mayors, etc. But for the most part, have kept it going well and have maintained that vision. And along the way, they were part of an initiative that we played a role in, introduced them to early childhood stuff. And they became leaders in school readiness programming and creating kindergarten and summer activities to get kids ready for school. So they had a collaborative table that they maintain all these years that has been the place where folks figure out how to stay on board here and to grow that initiative, which is a testament to their, not just their longevity, but a testament to their commitment as a community. And a lot of things have come and gone in that time. Strive came, and then some city leadership that didn't realize what they had decided that we need to do Strive here, and they figured out how to find some balance there. And I think one of the things, even in my own reflection, we over time, it's hard to keep and sustain a lot of these efforts for a lot of reasons, including political will, commitment, things coming and going, et cetera. But the places that have managed to do so, I think Cincinnati is another place, the example of which gave birth to Strive. But they too started out around that same time in the late 90s, where a juvenile court judge was inspired to do something different because she was tired of seeing kids in her courtroom and decided she wanted to work on the other end of the spectrum, on the preventive side, and created Community Learning Centers initiative. And that has now has grown and has had national renown, a lot of the schools there. And Cincinnati is not perfect, but it does remain a full district effort of keeping this going and still has the support of major funders, still has the support of major leadership, has managed to sustain itself through different superintendent leadership, et cetera. And so I think those are at least a couple of the examples. Albuquerque is another where they have maybe a slightly later start in figuring out how to get it going, but after that initiative got the right leadership, they really flew and have always had as a core through essentially a memorandum of understanding between the key agencies, the city, the county, the school district, et cetera, always had a context in which to work. A joint powers agreement, I think, is their language. But they have managed to keep that work going and sustain it across the board and continue to blend and braid and be creative and serve kids. So I think a lot of this is really being able to withstand change and have the people that keep their eyes on the main prize in spite of, because there's been obviously in the last 20 years, lots of changes.
And I think those are three really good examples. And I, in different ways, I know all three, and in different ways, but it's part of the same keeping one's eyes on the prize. Nomer was the one place within an Office of Juvenile Justice and Delinquency Prevention effort on reducing disproportionate minority confinement in detention that really succeeded because they kept on looking at the data and said, oh, we're not doing this well enough. Let's go back. It didn't say, okay, we tried. Let's go on to the next thing. And among other things, Cincinnati, to my knowledge, is the only public system in the country that is building Montessori schools to scale. That's what it's usually afforded in this country to only middle class kids. It's afforded to all kids within Cincinnati. This is part of, I think, keeping one's eye on the prize and not just getting caught in an initiative.
Yeah, none of these efforts are perfect, but I think they've been at it long enough so that there's always room for improvement and there's always room for engaging voices that have not always been active in the midst of that. I think part of this also is, as if you stick around long enough and their new frameworks are introduced, new names of things are introduced, new funding streams are produced because new funders are in the game. And I think where their hearts are in the right place is that by trying to fund innovation. But what often gets missed is that we don't just need innovation for innovation's sake, but we need to sustain what works well. And we need to also be, and this is where going back and actually looking at our practice, we need to understand in a deeper way, is the problem that the intervention was wrong-headed, or is the problem that we never really implemented it correctly or understood what the barriers, what the challenges were? And in a society that's always every couple of years wanting to go toward the new, you miss those lessons.
And if I am right, to go back to themes you brought in before about reflection and listening to the voices of others and their expertise, if families and youth are at the table in a way where there is a capacity for them to voice and be heard, then what often are seen as unanticipated consequences are actually anticipatable.
That's right. No, I think that's right. Yeah, because if you're not listening to everybody who is has something at stake, you could get lucky and get the right solution, but more often than not, you're missing something.
That's right.
And you're missing a critical voice, a critical insight, another way of looking at it. Or frankly, because particularly for historically underserved communities, a lot of stuff is done to them on their behalf, but not with them. And so that's a recipe for disaster more times than not.
And the voice and listening to voices even include listen to the voices of everybody. It's important for someone to be able to say, it's great to have the food, but I can't pay for it. Because otherwise, you
That's
have this
right.
wonderful plan, and lo and behold, there's no food.
There's no food. So it's been my job to add value to people's efforts to help boost their capacity, build their capacity, share insights, give them opportunities to learn from peers. And that's good. And that's been wonderful work for me personally to really add value to other efforts. It's been a long time since I was directly in city government, actually leading the kind of effort that I'm now trying to impact and support. I think the big missing piece in that now is the whole issue around collaboration and deep partnership being capacities. And so people can learn how to do that better. We have more evidence about what that looks like. People can actually learn what it takes to better engage families, the extra oomph. And again, it's really, I use language like this now because people can see that it's in that gap between practice and espouse values. That gap is where we've got to work. And in that gap, we bridge that gap through capacity building, intention, reflection, honesty, new systems and structures. That's how you deal with that gap. And when you're not doing that, then you'll pay lip service to the notion of it. And then all of us as organizations have to espouse that. Even for us, we deeply value the voice of families, but we have to figure out how to raise money to get, if we want to have family voice, we got to raise money because I have a budget and I can travel. Families don't have a budget. They can't get the stuff. They can't get off work. There's all these issues. Same thing with young people. We've got to do more to make sure that they actually have a meaningful voice at the table. And we've got to be clear about what that is. So, of course, you have to be in relationship with folks to understand what that is and not just make assumptions. But what in past practice, what we've done is basically just shy of being tokenism, where you just kind of give people a few slots and then they're just dropped in the deep side of the pool and expected to thrive somehow with all these other people who are seasoned veterans at whatever. And so I think that's the big difference all these years later. I think we've got more language and evidence from other fields that are informing these concepts around collaboration. It's always been a good idea to collaborate, but we know a lot more now about what it's going to take to do it well and to sustain it.
That's great, Kwesi, and it actually connects to subsequent podcast events because the next one that deals with Cleveland and the UCLA Community School and the fundamental elements of effective change, and the one that follows it that focuses on readiness will further elaborate on these really important points you're making. It's not enough to have a value. It's not enough to talk about the need for collaboration or the need for families to be at the table and young people. It is building that capacity and creating the conditions where those are real. So let me bring us to a near close by asking you, if I'm a hardworking community leader, school leader, someone working in a school or a community organization. And I want to take what you're saying and act on it right now. What are the things that I could be doing right now, no matter what are the pressures that I'm also facing?
Yeah.
What are the important low-hanging fruits that I should be looking for?
Yeah, I think it's, and again, it really depends on where you are in your work and your agency, et cetera. I do think a deep examination of what your strategies are currently, what's hitting and what's missing, who could you be working with or in dialogue with to maybe move the needle a little bit more, even if it's outside of official channels. What risk are you willing to take to say, hey man, we could, if we could have a relationship with this organization, that might help us go to the next level. But what would it look like to start a conversation without waiting on permission to do so? I'm not suggesting that people go out and risk their jobs, but a lot of this is about being creative with what you have and being honest about what results you're getting and why, and what could you be doing different with your energy, with your time, with your position. I think that's where I was starting. That's where I have always, and I've long career now, but it's always been about being in communication with like-minded folks who have similar values, but also just trying to make a difference with their time and not just collecting the paycheck and not as worried about it. I think surrounding yourself with people who don't think like you necessarily, but people who are committed to their work and committed to change, people who you can learn from. We don't hear as much about lifelong learners anymore. I've been a lifelong learner. I love being in settings where I can learn some stuff. I can be pushed. I can think about things differently. And I bring something to the table in those conversations today, but I'm also there. Oh, I didn't think about it that way. And who could I be in dialogue with to push my own thinking and have a, we talk about growth mindset, but that's what that is. It's like, what do I need to know to do better? And who can I be with? Who can I be around to learn from? Get some mentors, mentor some people, and get some mentors.
Great. Thanks a lot. This is really wonderful.